Hello.
Hola.
Hola, mi amigo.
How goes it?
Bien.
Bien. Sí.
Sí.
So how are you?
Pretty good. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's a good thing we did it this weekend, 'cause next weekend's the 4th of July.
Yeah, I keep forgetting that it's sneaking up on me for some reason. Because it's still June.
Yeah, it really, July just snuck up on me. Like, June went by so fast.
Yeah. And I think because the week starts in June and ends in the 4th of July, I keep
Yeah.
forgetting that. I keep forgetting that it's a 4-day work week.
Right.
But that's a good thing.
Yes.
That's a pleasant thing to be reminded of.
It is very pleasant.
But it hasn't been a ple very pleasant weekend here. It's been raining since yesterday morning, pretty much.
Ah, you stole our rain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty big storm over the area, over the region. Yeah,
Hopefully there won't be any flooding.
there's a flood watch, I think. We usually don't have any problems around our house, but it's definitely a possibility in the area. There's a lot of the houses, or most houses in the area, I think if they have a basement, they have a sump pump
Yeah.
case to help with basement flooding.
Yep. Suck it out.
Pump it out.
Pump it real good. Doot,
Pump it out
doot,
to
doot, doot.
the road. But yes, you are freshly back from this side of the country on the
Yeah.
East Coast.
It was a
I'm
good
here,
time.
Wisconsin.
Went by really fast, though.
Yeah. I always have a good time looking at everybody's photographs.
Yeah, it was fun. It was really good con. And just like every other con, we spend less and less time at the con. Think the first day we were there for 2.5 hours out of the whole day. And then the second day, maybe 3 or 4, maybe. And then maybe 4 on Sunday.
Well,
So it's
sometimes,
almost like one whole day.
yeah.
And then the rest of just hanging with people elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, I can definitely see how after a certain while you need a break from walking around the same big convention room.
Yeah. This is the first time
Yeah.
I felt like I didn't see everything or everyone. You know what I mean? Like I didn't even get to walk down all the rows or anything.
Do you feel like you missed out because of that or not really?
Nah, not
'Cause
at
that's
all.
not why you're there anyways.
Yeah, I'm not there for that's secondary.
That's good. And I think you did, although you don't tend to do a lot of shopping, I seem to recall you did pick up a few older comics, didn't you?
Yeah. So I picked up my Phantom Stranger commission, well, commission wise, and then I got a Looker commission and also a Katana commission. And I have a Spectre in the works. And comic wise, I spent a lot more than I usually do. And I only bought like 7 comics. But what I did get was stuff that I really, 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 really wanted because of my fixation with the Freedom Fighters. And I didn't know the Freedom Fighters prior to DC acquiring them, but I bought the Quality Companion and I kind of became obsessed with them as characters. And my goal was to at least try to get one of each character's Golden Age appearance. Not necessarily the first appearance, but one of them. And I managed to get an appearance of Well, I got a lot of Plastic Man. I got two more Plastic Man comics, Golden Age, which I'm starting to get at least in the double digits of Golden Age Plastic Man. And I got a Police Comics that featured the Human Bomb, which I was really happy,
That's
and
cool.
Phantom Lady. So I killed two birds with one stone there. I had already like four issues of Golden Age Doll Man. I had a couple of his comics, one in an anthology and one in his own, a couple of in his own book. And then I already had an Uncle Sam, but I bought two more Uncle Sams in National Comics. So the only ones I'm lacking, and I could have got one, and I kind of regret not getting it, but I'm gonna do that in Baltimore, is I did find one comic of the Black Condor, and he was on the cover. That's the hard thing to find, is usually they just appear in one of the circles. And I did see one of the Ray, and I didn't get that one either. But hopefully next con, those are the ones that I'll target.
Cool.
And that was pretty much all that I bought. I bought like a Charlton Arrow, and then Creature LLC was there, and I was missing Ravenous number one, and I picked that up, and then read this one about a serial killer tricks the serial killer or something like that. That was Tommy the serial killer, and it was spelled with a C, and C as in cereal. And yeah, those were really good. I already read those. So yeah, it was a good con. I got some good stuff. I was really happy with my commissions. I hope to get my Spectre soon. And I have one other commission in works that's not con related, and that's I just got the Shadow Pact done by Zach Bassett.
Yeah, that's a nice one.
Yeah. And I almost saw the first appearance of Detective Chimp, and I would have bought it. They had five, and I need number four of Rex the Wonder Dog. And I would have been really happy to scoop that up. But the other thing that I realized is Golden Age is somewhat affordable when you think about it. Like, I ran across a couple of, like, All Flash, like Golden Age Jay Garrick, and they were just over the cost of what a commission runs right now, you know? And like VG. And I was like, oh, think about this. And then I ran across a couple of All American comics, which featured Green Lantern, Alan Scott. And there was a lot of things I was looking at that I was like, man, this is awesome. But maybe next time. So I might start doing less and less commissions, because the price of commissions is just, whew, it's skyrocketed. Yeah.
Any thoughts on why that might be?
Because I think if people are paying it, so if people can pay and afford to spend $200, $300 a commission, and they're making what they would normally do if they did one commission as opposed to four commissions, then why not, right? You draw
Sure.
once instead of three, four times. And the other thing you always have to worry about, and I saw it happen to someone, is you never know what you're going to get. And if you get
True.
on someone's list that you like adore, well, you're on that list with 15 other people. And do they have time to do a good commission for you, or are they rushed? And are you the one that's going to be screwed? Because there are people that are screwed. You spend $300 and you get, well, that's a sketch. That's not like a work of art. But
I
yeah.
wonder, do you think that getting commissions has become more popular just
Oh yeah,
with?
I think it is, and now I'm starting to get pretentious in the commissions too, because I'm like starting to prefer color. But my katana, I don't know if you saw it, but god dang, it's awesome, by Gallant, Shannon Gallant. He does G.I. Joe.
Oh, yeah, definitely saw
Yeah,
that,
it
yeah.
was freaking freaking beautiful, man. And I think the looker came out really good, and that was just somebody who did one for 60, so I was pretty happy with that one.
Yeah, I haven't read a lot of comics that Shannon Gallant has drawn because I haven't
Yeah.
read a lot of his G.I. Joe work, but I would at some point like to, just because I do find his art to be really good. I think he's got a very classic kind of Bronze Age style.
Yeah.
His art kind of reminds me of, at least I see like there could be an influence of some of the artists that were drawing in the
Yeah,
Bronze Age.
yeah. Do you remember? I don't know if you listened to the DC Noise where Keith ranted kind of because he wanted a commission and he said, "Well, I can only do this many a day and I'm already booked. You have to come tomorrow morning and do it." Do you remember that?
I
I
think
don't.
so. It
I.
wasn't a
I.
recent episode, was it?
I no, it was about a year ago. I
Yeah, okay, then yeah, I
think it
definitely
was
did.
last year.
Yeah.
The thing that I like about him more than other people is like he's brutally honest. He knows what he can do and he knows the time he's going to spend on a commission. Like he doesn't rush it like at all. And that's what I love. And he's you like get on the list the day of, and that's totally fair. Like he keeps his commission list so he's got it open on every day of the list. A lot of artists they fill up on day one. So if you're not there on Friday at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. when the con opens, you're fucked because it fills up like within the hour.
Right, and then people that
Yeah.
just, if they are just like, a lot of times local people will go maybe just one day or something if they're
Yeah.
not traveling for the con, so.
Yeah. So like, I think his mechanism, even though you might not get one because he's already filled up, is the fairest, I think, to everybody that's going to a 3-day convention. And like there's one piece that I'm still waiting for because it's not done. And they said, "Oh yeah, I have you on my list and we'll have it by Sunday," but it won't. But this guy I trust and I have many commissions that I'm gonna get it, you know what I mean? So I'm not like worried because I've never dealt with this guy before, you know what I mean? I know I'm gonna get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'd rather have somebody brutally honest tell me, "No, I don't have time." Then you're not stressed about walking by on Sunday and saying, "Oh, well, shit, he's sketching this like in 10 minutes." You know?
Sure, yeah.
I don't want that. I want somebody to spend time with it 'cause I think it's good money.
Yeah,
When
definitely.
you think about it, $300 an hour is not a bad job.
No,
I
no.
mean, come on, man. I mean, spend that time, spend that whole hour or whatever it takes. 2 hours if it need be. I think for a $300 piece, it ought to be 3 hours, but.
Yeah, at least if you're paying the same amount as other people, then your piece should get the same amount of time. It should be based on a time factor.
Yeah.
No. At least that's what I would expect as a purchaser,
Yeah, I'd
if I.
recommend getting one because it's so fun though, like just to have a piece like that.
Yeah, I would like to get a few at some point to hang with the comics, in the comics room, and I do sort of pay attention to what I hear from different podcasters and different people who collect art, and I see a lot of stuff that you get, and so in the back of my mind, I've started to know some of the artists that do a good job. Because, like you said, even though you don't know what you're going to get, if you see enough commissions by an artist, then
You
you,
so sort of know, yeah.
yeah, like you kind of have an idea of what you're going to get, the quality that they usually come out with, so.
Yeah. If you get somebody to recognize too, like both of the artists that I asked for outsiders from, they had a fond memory of the outsiders, so they like knew in their head exactly. They're like, "Oh yeah, Alan Davis," or they start naming artists and they're like, "Yeah, I'm excited." When they do that, you know you're going to get a good piece. And you happen to roll the dice and find something that they love, because they, I think artists get tired of drawing the same stuff. Like, they like to draw. Like, Shannon, if he gets something that's non-G.I. Joe, he's, like, happy. He's like, yeah, I get to try something different.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me. So.
But, yeah, it was a fun con, and I ate my first, I guess, I don't know if it's a vegan. I don't know. Is vegan always uncooked?
No.
Well, I ate my first uncooked vegan, whatever that's called. Natural.
Raw.
Raw.
Yeah, raw yeah. Cooking. Yeah.
And I'm glad I ate it, because now I'll know I'll never want it again. It was awful.
It could be all kinds of it all depends on the ingredients. It's kind of the same thing as saying I never want to eat anything that's cooked again because I had something cooked that was nasty.
Yeah, but I tried a couple of things, and it was all like, it tastes like you're eating out of the garden without doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just, there's a cucumber, I'm going to chew on it. There's some hummus, and I didn't like any of the hummuses, and the falafel tasted like dirt, and it's honest to godness, everybody at the table thought it was like dirt.
Mm.
Even the people that love that restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
it was like eating some dirt. Like, if you just went and picked up some dirt and ate it,
that's weird.
What it was.
I love falafel normally.
Yeah.
But
it was funny too. It was a good time. Daryl was a good sport. Daryl finished his plate. He ate lasagna.
Yeah, I've never been there, of course, but I've been to some raw food restaurants. The ones that I've gone to, what I've had has been really good. But
yeah, I'm not a fan of let's mash up some nuts and put some water on it and it's your cheese, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They make everything out of nuts. Like, that's your protein.
Yeah, a lot of it
is,
yeah. Yeah,
so
that's your protein.
You have to be like a nut lover. They like use nuts for cheese and nuts for sauces and everything. It's all nut based.
Nuts and vegetables, yeah.
And I don't think it's salted either. Like I like salted peanuts and salt. I think it's just natural. But salt is natural. I don't know. I didn't taste any salt.
Yeah, it could have salt. I mean, as far as raw cooking goes, it could have salt. And I mean, I think, I don't know how they prepare their stuff there. The raw food that I've had has used a lot of spices and herbs and stuff. And that's where you get a lot of the flavor from.
I had some... I had some burger, like it was a burger, like, and it was warm, and I don't know how they warmed it, because they don't use stoves or anything. I think they put it on the roof of the building, because I saw people walking up the stairs and just let it heat up. That's what I think.
Yeah, maybe.
But it tasted like curry, and I don't like that at all. Like, I don't like Indian food at all.
Well,
at least what I've tried in a buffet. Like, I didn't go like out of my way to go to a bunch of different restaurants. I tried a buffet once or twice, and I was like, try this, try that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love
the spices. The spices do something to me, and it's not like I can't eat hot. I mean, you know, I eat hot.
Yeah.
I'll eat habanero peppers and all kinds of stuff. It's whatever spices they use that I just
don't
like. Yeah,
it would be not the heat of the spices, but
it's not even the heat. It's
right,
the flavor.
The flavor.
Yeah.
It is a different kind of flavor. I mean, I like hot. I like spicy foods, and I like both Mexican and Indian food. But they are definitely a different type of flavor. I agree. Well, at least you tried it. Now you can't say, no one can say that you didn't.
Yeah, it was fun. I would do it again. I mean, if it was with those guys, definitely. I did like, I ate this like Popeye drink. It was a spinach, fruit-based kind of, what do they call those smoothies? Like
Smoothies or just
Yeah,
it could just be it
it
might be
was
just juice.
delicious. It was no, it was like a smoothie.
Yeah, it had
It was great.
thickness to it. Yeah, that's I like green juices and smoothies and stuff. They give you a lot of energy too.
Yeah, I would have been happy just drinking that. Like, I was already full after I drank that. I ordered that as my drink. And I saved a little bit just to wash stuff down.
Yeah,
Because if you don't li like something, you could just say it, just start drinking it.
you can get really full off of some of those. I know some of the smoothies that my wife makes, they're packed with different stuff and they have a lot of nutrients and stuff. But
Yeah.
anyhow.
All
Yes, it
right,
looked like
so
you had a good time.
that's our wrap up. And plus, I saw a lot of people. I met David Levine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I
That's
ran
very cool.
across him in front of Drew Moss's table, and he recognized me, so that was cool. I got to meet him. He's really, really nice guy.
Yeah, he.
And William Purcell, he listens to our podcast. I met him and his wife, and I thought they were both fantastic. I got to talk to his wife for a long time about she works at the Natural History Museum, and
Oh, that's cool.
she yeah, she just read Tom. It's funny because Daryl's funny. Like you go to con with Daryl, and like you don't even have to walk around. You just sit there. I just me and him just laugh. It's like an episode of DC Noise or whatever, you know. It's like we just laugh at our own jokes. It's so stupid. We sit there and laugh. But he was like pimping Tom King's books, you know, Grayson, and
Yeah.
he was doing it so funny. He had one book, and he'd like it was the last day of the con. He's like, buy some Grayson, get some dick, you know. He's rubbing it on his nipples and everything, and
Oh
he
boy.
actually sold one to William's wife, and she liked it. She liked it a lot, and
Oh, that's
she even
cool.
got William to read it, and William was kind of like, that's not my dick. You know, kind
Yeah.
of like a Knutson thing. So
Yeah,
yeah, that was a good thing. So yeah, I met some new people. It was a lot of fun. Some listeners of the show. So that was cool.
that is cool. I was happy to see that you got to meet both those guys.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with Bill, like Bomer, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Because even when the night was done, he'd come over to our hotel room and just hang out. And it was we keep getting this awesome hotel room. Like it's got two rooms. It's got like a living room and then the bedroom and a little kitchen area, and it's got a conference room table. So it's like a great place to hang out, you know, afterwards.
So you can have a geek brunch conference.
Yeah. We
Just
should
break
have
down
brought I should have brought a recorder, 'cause we could have recorded like five episodes, but
the
that's what it was. But it was a lot of fun. Spent a lot of time with Chris Campbell. Not as much time as I'd like to. We got to have one really good meal with them where we were sitting right across from him. That was when I got drunk. But
Yeah, you had two beers in a row, didn't you?
no, well, that beer, it was in not in a sequential order, but this was like a powerful beer. Like I felt it, like it hit me. It was like 8%, nine and a
Oh,
half
man.
percent, 9.5, and I felt it. Like I was halfway through the drink, and I'm lightweight, guaranteed.
Start
But
taking your
I
clothes
already
off.
start. I, no, I didn't take my clothes off, but I already started to feel like the I don't know. It's like this loopiness. I don't know how to describe it, but my head was feeling light and
Yeah, most people listening to this know what you mean. That's what alcohol it's that's what's supposed to It's called intoxication.
don't normally feel that.
No, you wouldn't, yeah, if you don't
Like
drink.
usually a four won't do anything to me. Like later
Right.
on, I drank one of those big old tall glasses of cider, and I think that's not even, I don't know what it was, but That did nothing.
Yeah, well, yeah, because if you had one that was nine something, then that's the alcohol of two regular beers, like a, just your average lager,
Yeah.
so, and then you're, if you drank half your 9.5% beer, that's like you drank one regular beer, but in half the time,
Yeah.
So it's about alcohol.
But you know what? The taste of that, I really liked it. Like the one that was the 9.5, I don't know what Campbell picked. But that's why I got it, is 'cause he let me have a sip of it and I was like, "Hey, that's pretty good." And
How dark was it?
it was a light.
Oh, was it light?
Yeah. And usually the lights to me have like this aftertaste, at least, and it's more bitter than something that's darker, And I'm not a beer specialist at all, but I just know what it tastes like to me. And it was good. It was really good.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking you about color and stuff, and not
Yeah.
was it a IPA or
I have no idea what it
No, I know.
was.
Yeah,
I have to ask Campbell what it is.
that's just
But
why I just went with the color question.
yeah.
But yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with Knudsen and Luke and damn it, Cunningham. And we had a big dinner with all of us one evening.
Yeah, I
So it
think I
was,
saw a picture of that. The
yeah,
table people.
that was a good time.
Yeah, there's actually an app. Well, the app that I use to record my solo shows is on my phone. It's called Boss Jock.
Ah.
Does a pretty good job. Maybe Baltimore, we'll see if we can use it to
Yeah.
record something. But alrighty.
All right.
Well, I think the last few times we've started with Buck. So I don't
Okay.
know if you want to switch things up and either start with questions or comics.
Oh, we just have one question, but let's go ahead and do it.
I got
This
a couple. I shared your post and I got a couple on mine
Okay.
too. So
I
I guess we have
got one
three.
from Bill Zanowitz and from the Comic Book Bears podcast, and he said, "What is your favorite Superman villain?" And to me, that's a tough one. Well, it's kind of tough and not tough because he doesn't have like the rogues gallery that like Flash, like the ones that I like, like Batman, Like, I have a lot of favorites. So it would be tough, but I would have to go with the most common one, Lex. And it's just because Lex Luthor's hatred for this alien, or any aliens, he always wants to be on the top of the human pedestal. And he always has that fear that these people with powers will take over the earth. And he's always one step ahead of him. He has to be with his mind. So yeah, I like Lex Luthor a lot. My second honorable mention is I like Parasite a lot because yeah, they defeat him relatively quickly, but he's pretty cool, man. He just absorbs like everything. And usually they have the only way they usually beat him is by overpowering him. But those are my favorite.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way that you are. A lot of my favorite villains, well, I don't think any of my favorite villains are Superman villains. They're either Batman or Flash ones or JSA ones. But so the first one that comes to mind, of course, and be the case for a lot of people, be Lex Luthor. But I could give a couple honorable mentions to Ultra Humanite, which kind of has become more associated with the JSA, but
That
technically,
that's what I know him from.
yeah. But I mean, technically, he kind of started out as a Superman villain.
Yeah.
I like the way that he transfer, he'll put his brain into different bodies. It's kind of a neat gimmick. Spending probably most known is in the gorilla, but he's used other bodies. Brainiac too.
Yeah, he's a big
Give a
one.
shout out to him.
He's been
I used to.
oversaturated lately, though.
Yeah.
It's like over and over. I'm starting to get tired of him. I love his son, though. Real Docs. I love Real.
Yeah, I kind of like that connection
Yeah.
to the Legion and stuff, but right, well, speaking of William Purcell, the two questions I have are from him.
Well, let's just give a quick shout out. One guy that's been becoming and actually appeared in Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, that's been like a big Superman villain, even though he kind of fights the entire DC universe, is Darkseid.
Oh yeah, I meant to mention him.
Yeah, and a shout out to Doomsday, who's also known associated with. And then you have all the Supermans that came out of the death of Superman, like Eradicator and all of the
Cyborg
Cyborg
Superman.
Superman and all that. And General Zod has become really popular as of late.
Zod's another one, yeah, that they meant that usually is mentioned on lists, and Metallo.
Yeah, the one that's a pain in the ass and always usually beats Superman but says his name's backwards is Mr. Mxyzptlk.
Let's pick a look, yeah. That one too. Yeah, I think that kind of now I think covers most of the big ones.
Yeah, Toy Man, but Ultraman, which is the
Oh yeah.
crime syndicate,
Yeah, I guess I think of the crime
prankster.
syndicate as a JLA. I think of them as a group, but
Yeah.
he's the Superman member of the crime syndicate.
Bizarro.
Oh right, yeah.
Yeah, an
That one.
Atomic Skull, and the other one that we're missing is Metallo. Those are the big ones. And Mongol.
Yeah, Metallo I said, but yeah, Mongo.
Yeah.
Mongol, yeah. Is the other one that I'm usually on lists of Superman villains.
So William asked you a question.
Yeah, I got two. First one is, what classic Kirby character or characters do you most relate to? So I'm taking that not so much as your favorites, but ones that you sort of have some affinity with or some sort of relation to, however you want to interpret that. I'll give you a chance to think about it because I already saw the question, and I'll say that one character that kind of represents an ideal for me in behavior is Captain America.
Yeah.
I like the way that he doesn't disregard patriotism, doesn't represent hatred towards America, but he tries to embody the best aspects of it and not and just and leave behind the negative things. And he tries to he's not perfect, but he tries to be perfect in the way that he treats other people.
And have a consistent way of thinking, like,
Yeah. He doesn't try to favor one type of person over another, and it's been an interesting character for different writers to write because I think each of them sort of ends up bringing into it a little bit of maybe not always politics, though sometimes it involves politics, but just the idea of American identity. And another one I thought of was Cyclops, and more so Cyclops, not so much Cyclops more recently, but the earlier incarnations of Cyclops in the first couple decades he was around. And this is a character that has is maybe overly serious and has a little bit of a weight on his shoulders, burden of sorts that maybe doesn't really need to be there. There's definitely been times in my life where I feel like I carried a weight on my shoulders that I didn't necessarily have to, you know. So that character I feel some relation to, at least certain incarnations of the character.
Yeah, that's a tough one for me. I don't know if I relate to. I can't think of like the term relate to, but
Yeah, I mean, you can always interpret it in a different way too.
there's so much of his creations. But I guess on the DC side, I would relate to Scott Free the most. Not that I came from. Not that I was traded at birth and lived on Apocalypse or anything, but just his attitude. I don't know if you ever notice his attitude, but he's always optimistic and always tries to get out of situations by problem solving and stuff. And I guess I would relate to him.
That's
I'd
it.
like to be more relatable to Captain America, but he's too perfect. I could take
Yeah.
certain aspects, but he's just.
Yeah, that's why I kind of said not, I don't so much relate to him as if I, as in I'm like him, but I kind of see him as an ideal.
I could relate to him in the fact that I believe I'm consistent in my way of thinking. I'm consistent, so. I think Cap has always had a consistency about him.
I certainly try to. I think I'm a lot more consistent in my 30s than I was when I was younger. For sure.
So yeah, I'll go with Scott Free.
All right, I like that answer. And then he just asks, in your mind, what constitutes a classic comic? And to me, I think that a classic comic is not just a comic that is a 5 out of 5 or however you want to say it's a really great comic, but one that has a sort of historical significance and historical to comic books, you know, something that's important to the history of comic books and the development of comic books, and that has an influence on comic books that follow it. So it's sort of a succinct answer, but I think there are a lot of classic comics, and it doesn't have to be, you know, one of the top 10 most influential ever to be a classic comic. But so I think there's a lot of comics you could call as classic, but ones that are worth mentioning years later for some reason, you know, that are also quality.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that. It's the same answer I would say.
Yeah.
Anything that has historical significance, which is every comic to me. Even the ones I don't like, it has historical significance to me.
just say that in case Barbara ever says, "Why don't you just get rid of all the ones except for the classic
That's
ones?"
right.
You're like, "Okay, I'll do that." You didn't get rid of any comics. That's right. Okay, well, that's all the questions, I think. So, do you want to get into some comic books?
Sure. You were
Want
first or me?
you can go ahead and start.
All right, well, I have a bunch of small ones, but I'll do like half of them now and then half later. But
Okay.
inside of the Quality Companion that Tomorrow's published, there's several snippets of various comics. And what I did is I read all the ones that pertain to the freedom fighters. So there was a one of the Ray done by Lou Fine and appeared in Smash Comics number 19 from 1941. This was my least favorite, but it was still well drawn and interesting. Back in these days, most of the villains you see are not super powered. They're really like mobsters and crime lords and stuff like that. And this is a story. You know what's amazing is the sophistication of these stories. What I'm starting to believe is they were darker and more sophisticated in Golden Age and then lightened up in the Silver Age. And
No, I can see
my
that.
favorite age is the Bronze Age. But this plot involved them capturing a criminal, putting him in prison, but this guy owned the whole city, this mobster. So when he was in prison, he had like TV, the warden treated him like a king. He always had cocktails and whatever, and he did what he needed to do. Well, one of the guys that got him arrested was murdered, and the Ray have to go find out how he got murdered, and he knew who it was, and he's a reporter. So he Terrell went and got proof and found out that this guy was running the mob still from prison, and had to come after him and his goons, and eventually defeated him and his mob, and that's how that ended. But it was a pretty cool story. It was my least favorite of the bunch. The ones that I enjoyed the most are the characters I enjoyed the most. It's really weird. The Phantom Lady is one of my two favorite freedom fighters are Phantom Lady and the Human Bomb. And Phantom Lady was a great story. It was awesome. It was basically the mob getting tired of them being defeated by Phantom Lady and this other lady, the Spider Widow. So what they did is they sent letters to both of them, and they put them from each other, so it made them sound like they were jealous of this character called the Raven, who's also a Golden Age character. And they put them at a duel against each other, so they like turn the two heroes against each other based on a love interest. That's pretty awesome. These mobsters have thought of that, and it looked like they're gonna beat the crap out of each other. And they actually, the mobsters, as they were fighting, were behind this like hill, and they pulled out their guns and started shooting at them like they were just gonna kill them. They're gonna kill Phantom Lady and the Spider Widow and Raven, and the only one that got shot was the Raven, but they managed to pull him in to like a ditch, and they ended up taking out everybody, but the Raven ended up in the hospital, and they found out that they ended up teaming up when they realized that they didn't write the letters to each other about this guy. But I really enjoyed that story. And then the next story was the Black Condor. Okay, so that Phantom Lady story was by Frank. Well, the art, you sometimes don't know who did the story because they never were credited. But in the case of the Phantom Lady, it was by Frank Borth. And it was presented in Police Comics number 21. And it was titled The Phantom Lady versus the Spider Widow. And the next one I'll talk about is the Black Condor, which was also a great one. Black Condor and the Ray have always been my least favorite. Well, the Ray I started to like when Quesada and them took over, and he had his own series. I really grown to like the Ray, but as a freedom fighter, he was never one of my favorite. The same could be said with Black Condor. Like I like the Native American Black Condor in the 90s, like really cool character. But as a freedom fighter, I never thought much of him. This story was awesome. It was this I, man, this one's probably gonna be my favorite. It was in Crack Comics number 9, and the art was by Lou Fine, and the story was by Kenneth Lewis. The art was awesome. Like it had like a scratchiness to it that I really dug, that I think could even stand up today. I liked it a lot. But it did look Golden Age. Like people would freak out if they saw this art, but it just looked really cool. It looked like something that I would like to see like in a book. So this one opens up. It's a cool story because it's another mob story where these mob guys are framing these immigrants and they're blackmailing them. They essentially were saying, we're going to report you to the United States so you can get deported kind of thing. And this is from the 40s, right? So they had to keep paying these mob guys. They were making money off of this poor family for years, and they ended up hurting the husband, and he was in the hospital because he didn't make a payment. Well, the Black Condor found out by the father in the hospital bed, and he went after these mobsters to get justice, and it was a really cool story. I dug it. And that's the one I'll stop with, and I'll cover the human bomb and Uncle Sam later. But those are cool stories. This was from Crack Comics. This is the one I had an opportunity to get, and I wish I would have because it was the only. I did see a bunch of Ray comics, but I didn't. I only saw one Black Condor from Crack Comics. So the thing I did like about the Crack Comics though is that the Black Condor was featured as the main cover character, the issue that I did see. But that was from 1941. So we had 1941, 1943, and 1941. But they were cool stories. I really dug them.
Nice. Yeah, those are even more retro than a lot of the stuff we cover on the show.
Yeah, I went golden age.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I went indie because I feel like it's been a while. Been covering a lot of DC and Marvel, and I, since the beginning of the year, I've been keeping track of what I've read, and I recently did some. I put everything on a spreadsheet, the numbers, and I was curious to see that it's been a very big two heavy year for me in my reading this year so far. I've read mostly DC Marvel stuff, not a lot of
From
indie stuff.
a retro perspective or in general?
Everything, including everything.
Yeah.
I haven't read a lot of Image or for whatever reason. I mean, it wasn't on purpose, just kind of happened that way. I guess I've just been into superheroes or something lately.
Yeah.
Or this year, I don't know. But so I thought I'd change it up, and everything I read this time, I read for a little while now. I've been subscribing to this service called Scribd, and I found out about them because they added comics a while back. But
Yeah.
I've read some comics on it. I've been using it a lot to listen to audiobooks also, because it started out as audiobooks and ebooks. And so I've used that for those reasons too, but I've originally found out about it because of the comics. And I have the app on my Kindle. And so first thing I read was, it's on there because IDW has the rights now. It's Grimjack.
Yeah.
But it was originally First Comics, I think. Wasn't I think Grimjack was
Yeah,
first.
yeah.
Yeah.
It's Tim Truman, isn't it?
Yeah, art by Tim Truman, written by John Ostrander. And this is, I know for a lot of fans, this is a classic. The 11 o'clock forums are named after the bar in the series and stuff. And I have never read it, but it's been on my list to check out at some point. And IDW published a couple omnibuses of the series, and that's what Omnibus Volume 1, at least. I don't know if Volume 2's on here or not, but IDW has, probably out of all the publishers that are on here, has the most stuff available. So I read what I guess this covers stories from Star Slayer, which I think Grimjack started out as the backup as of Star Slayer.
Yeah.
And then it went into its own series. And so I read the first two stories in here, which I believe were from Star Slayer's issues 10 and 11. It does start with kind of a, I think it was newly made for this 9-page introduction that just sort of brings you to the world that the stuff takes place on. And then the first story is called Mortal Gods. John Ostrander and Timothy Truman. And Grimjack, he's sort of a, I'd say, like a bounty hunter type guy. And the two stories are sort of introductory. He's on a job, and a woman with red hair comes looking for him, and she says that she's looking for her god. Her name is Elvana, and she's the high priestess of a people called the Kyrians, and that their lands have been recently invaded by followers of a god named Zago. And we see in the beginning of the story, before we join Grimjack, a little bit of that happening. We see the priestess doing some rites and stuff. And while her people are on the verge of extermination, and they've been trying to contact their own god, Manwes, with their prayers, but they haven't been answering. So they tried this rite that was supposed to bring her to where the god lives, but instead, she ends up in this place where Grimjack is, and no one has ever heard of her god. But she comes to find Grimjack because she heard from somebody that he might know her god. So they're in this city called Sinishure, and it's this kind of meeting place of the multiverse that there's. You can be walking down the street, and you could cross the street and end up crossing into a different dimension, and so it's this wild place where anything can happen. And they go into this place called Wu Fang's Cantina, and he points out this old man to her, this old guy with long beard and long hair, and he's looks like he's totally drunk. It's a real dive place. There's a bunch of bottles around on the table, and he's barely holding his head up off the table. And he says, "There's the man we want," pointing her out to the priestess. She says, "You mean he can lead us to my god? I mean, he is your god. Elvana, meet Manny Weeze, alias Weevil, alias Manwees." And the guy looks up and tells Grimjack he'll kill him for pointing her out. So the second story from the next issue of Star Slayer is the conclusion of the previous one. And the priestess is immediately upset that he would suggest that this old drunken man is her god. And the old man tries to get up to threaten them, and falls over drunk, smacking his face on the ground. And just at that moment, as they're helping him, the old man up off the floor, Zago, the leader of the people that are the creatures that are destroying the priestess's people, shows up, and he's searching for this man Weeze as well. He's kind of like pink skin. It looks somewhat sort of reptilian, almost kind of like the Brood, a little bit of the X-Men, but he's got multiple arms, and there's a bit of a short conflict happens between him and Grimjack. Grimjack's pretty svelte and quick, and is able to dodge and get around Zago pretty quickly, and they take the fight outside. And Zago starts, or Grimjack starts shooting Zago. Zago's molecular structure is really dense, so the bullets are just bouncing off of the creature. And it seems that Manwees ended up was just a man who had wandered into the dimension where the priestess lived, and being in that dimension, almost kind of like Superman in a way, he had all these powers all of a sudden in that dimension, and he was taken to be a god. So at first he enjoyed the attention, but then constantly being accountable for everything that happened and all the pressure of it, of having these followers, he couldn't take it, so he ran back to the city of Sinnoh-Sher, where he's just a regular old man. And this is kind of discussions happening between the two of them while there's still a lot of fighting going on, mostly between Zago and Grimjack. And Grimjack's starting to get wary, and the old man's telling him, forget about it, it's not worth it. And Grimjack asks for his staff. He takes his staff from the old man, and he makes his final move as able to dislodge the sword from one of Zago's hands, and he's able to finally finish off the battle against Zago with some quick moves. And so the resolution, last page, is bit of a conversation between the three characters. Is the priestess is a little not sure what to do. She's the land that she came from, her people, they've mostly been decimated, and she's pretty much spent her life in service of this man who she thought to be a god. And now, even though she knows he's a old man and not a god, he seems to need her help, so she wants to stay and try to help him. And Grimjack's sort of cynical about the whole thing. The priestess says to him, "You can mock me, but at least I've found my god. What gods do you worship, Mr. Grimjack?" And he looks at her for a panel. Says, "All of them, lady." And as he's walking away, he repeats, "All of them." So it was a pretty neat story. The two backups kind of make up one issue in a way. But I'm interested to read more, because I believe part of the appeal is the location, the city, and the way that a lot of different stuff can happen. And I think just from one story, you can't get that feel, because you have to read more stories to see the variety of things that happen and the nature of the Sinnoh-Sher city. But it was a pretty neat story, and just the sense of this character being thought a god and his worshiper coming to look for him, and turning out that not that he's a false god, or in the sense that he was just pretending or using illusions or tricks to put it over these people, but that he had actually traveled into another dimension and gotten powers, and the powers were genuine. But as far as his psyche and his mental capabilities and stuff, he was still a human and couldn't really handle having that level of responsibility, and so he was willing to give up his powers and just become a drunk because he couldn't handle it. So I like the subtle difference there that kind of adds some emotional resonance to it. So good start to the series, I thought. Did I put you to sleep?
I'm on mute. I was asking, were they 16-page stories because they were a backup, or were they like full stories?
They are less than full stories. I'll take a look here, see how many of the pages they actually were. But no, I think that they were maybe. They felt more like half of a full issue. So it'll take me a minute to figure out here, but it covers issues 10 through 17 of
It's probably
Star
like
Slayer.
10 to 12
Yeah.
pages then.
And then issues 1 through 13 of Grimjack, and I do know there's another volume.
And you could buy those really cheap. Star Slayer is pretty damn cheap. You can get the first appearance of Grimjack. But you know what else I found while you were talking about Grimjack is something that I want to order.
As usually happens.
Barb's sitting at the table now, so that's not good. But I went in my database while you're looking at Grimjack, while you're talking Grimjack, and I saw a little note on issue number 26 of Grimjack. And this is one of their first full color appearances of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and it's like
Oh, okay.
dirt cheap. I think I want to buy it, and it's by Eastman and Laird, so I definitely want to check out Grimjack number 26. I'm gonna start a speculator thing.
Yeah, Speculator's Corner.
Speculator's Corner. Mike speculates this book is gonna go up because I say it is.
You know what's I just noticed was hot, and this is an aside because it's not a retro comic, but The Flash, like the new 52 series. I guess because of the TV show.
Oh, the new series, right? Are you reading it?
Yeah, I haven't. Let me see. I think I read up to 38, issue 38 or something like that. I
It
haven't read the
is
last
so
couple.
much like the TV show now.
Yeah, I've heard it's gotten
It
more
like
like the
even
TV
the
show.
this last issue after the Convergence, man, I mean, it's got some weird stuff that are definitely different, but man, it feels like the TV show.
Yeah.
It's almost like that's the direction they said, keep it close to the TV show. Even though they have that other Flash TV show comic, the digital first,
Right.
it looks like that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised. I kind of would rather have them do something different, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
But,
But yeah, this is an interesting. I'm gonna have to tell Paul about this because he's from the Valiant Central podcast to see if he knows about it. Because I didn't know about it, but it's all over eBay. The people that are selling it for dirt cheap know that it's. Some of them know that it's the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles appearance. It's a backup. It's one of their first color appearances. A lot of the people that are selling it are saying TMT in color, which is one
Yeah.
of the first times that it's represented. This actually said, this one I trust more. It's a second color Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I wonder what the first one is. Yeah, I do some research. But yeah, Grimjack. I've read very little Grimjack. I think I've read IDW made Grimjack come back for a while. And I've read the two Grimjack series that spawn off of, they were in the 90s,
Yeah.
Yeah. I've read those.
Okay.
And I enjoyed them. Well, I like Jim Shooman's art, so
Yeah.
Jon Ostrander's pretty awesome. I read Killer Instinct, and the other one I read is Grimjack the Manx Cat. So
Yeah, I've seen those listed. Yeah, I like Jon Ostrander's writing, at least what I've read of his, I usually have liked.
yeah, he's good. I enjoy Jon Ostrander, and Tim Truman's art is. He's not kind of like a he's kind of like a Mike Grell for me, but not I like Mike Grell a little bit more, but I like Tim Truman. He recently drew some Convergence Hawkman.
Oh, right, yep. Yeah.
So yeah, Tim Truman, I dig his stuff. He recently did a series with his son where his son wrote the story and he drew it, and it was under the IDW banner. I can't remember what the title was, but I read it and I enjoyed it. It was a Western-based theme. So, my next book is also from the Quality Companion, and it is, if I can find the page, it is The Human Bomb from Police Comics number 21 from 1943. I don't know why I've always liked the look of the character. I have a couple of commissions of the Human Bomb, but his costume's not that interesting. It's just like a nuclear reactor suit that you'd wear to be protected. But I find it fascinating. This story I loved because it was just so bizarre. It was just apeshit crazy. But the interesting thing is the guy who is the human bomb in his altered ali in his alias identity tries to go to the local draft board and join the war effort along with some criminal guy, and a guy who swallows swords. That's from his his name is Roy Lincoln, and the other guy, the bully guy, is Mr. McGurk. And then there's a sword swallower. His name is Sordo, and the draft board will not take him. She says, "You can't get in the army, any of you. Now, please get out of here and stop pestering me." And the bully tells the woman, "I wish she was a man so he could punch her." And the human bomb character, Roy Lincoln, says, "Draft regulations, phooey," and they won't let the sword swallower in either. So they decide to go fight the war in Japan, with this woman that has a plane. So you got a sword swallower, a criminal dude, and the human bomb going over to Japan and to rescue somebody, this woman's sister. I mean brother. He's being tortured by the Japanese in a prison camp in Tokyo. They spell Tokyo different too. So I do want to look at to see if there's any historical significance to the spelling of Tokyo. It's Tokio. But he's being tortured by this guy, and he always wears gloves because he just blows stuff up. But he also gives these guys like little explosive pellets that he dynamite. He calls it 27 QRX, and he gives them these pellets so they can use later on while they're in Japan to rescue this guy. And he's being tortured for secrets. He's a military guy. And they get there, and they the human bomb, yeah, he's got like this cool power. He's blowing up guns and stuff and beating up a lot of Japanese. But you got this guy that's a sword swallower who's just throwing these little pellets that the human bomb gave him. And he's a goofy looking character. And then you got this like bully guy who obviously is like a enforcer for the mob, that beats up people. He's just punching Japanese left and right. And they end up rescuing the guy and then taking off. But it's such a bizarre story that they actually tried to join the military and were turned down. I could see the sword swallower because he just doesn't look like fit, and the other guy because of his criminal record, but I have no idea why they wouldn't allow Roy into the military. He couldn't take his gloves off, but they don't know
Yeah.
that.
He could be an asset.
Yeah, but it was a cool little story. I really dug it. And I don't know if I said who the story was by, Paul Gustafson. So I really enjoyed that. And then the Uncle Sam one was really cool too. It was by William Eisner, and art by Reed Crandall. So Eisner wrote it and Crandall drew it. I really like the art style. But Uncle Sam's really unusual character. He has a sidekick that's always with him. And he's a boy. He looks like he'd be about 7 years old. And he's taking them in this crazy adventures that are war, during the war. And it's just really bizarre. They end up going to the Panama Canal because there's a lot of trade things and weird things going on there. And it's related to the Nazis. So the one cool thing that I started on Facebook was Pop Culture References in Comics. It's a Facebook group that I always take pictures of when I find pop culture references in comics because I always find it fascinating. Well, in this, I'm starting to get like references in the 40s because I'm so into the 40s now. And on the plane ride, Uncle Sam was tapped. He says, "Let's play this game." He's playing this game with the boy, and he's like, "I'm gonna tap something on." He's just gonna tap it with his shoe, and he says, "You get to guess what song I'm tapping out." And he tapped out the Chattanooga Choo Choo, the Andrews Sisters. And I was just like, "It's like that is awesome," and that plays into the story later on, because when Uncle Sam and this whole plane is hijacked essentially and brought down in the Panama Canal, and they're put all in prisons, which they're gonna kill people. Well, Uncle Sam is the only one that breaks out of that prison and disguises himself, and he tries to speak Spanish, which is kind of funny because of the area that they're in. And he actually puts on like a fake goatee and mustache, so Uncle Sam looks, and he's disguising himself as this guy called Pedro. And the boy manages to get a couple of the people on the flight out of the prison by he asks for one of the stewardess's glasses, and he fastens it to a pole. And he's able to like la find the keys and latch onto the keys with the glasses and bring the keys in and free them. And they manage to escape. And Uncle Sam ends up on this ship where he's destroying these guys, but they're gonna blow the ship out of the water, and they can't communicate with Uncle Sam. They can't find Uncle Sam to save him in the PT boat once they escape, because there's thousands of boats in the Panama Canal, and they have no idea where Uncle Sam is. But then the kid says, "Hey, I have an idea. We can have him. We can tap out like a song, so Uncle Sam will be able to. They'll be able to find Uncle Sam." So that came into play as the tapping thing. But yeah, it was a cool story. I liked all of them. The only one that I didn't care for was LeRae. All the others I really, really enjoyed. And there's still a couple more I have to read, but they're not so related to the Freedom Fighters. One is the Midnight. He's a character in Smash Comics with art by Jack Cole. Firebrand, who was one of the characters running alongside of Phantom Lady and the Human Bomb in Police Comics by Lee Ames. And Wildfire is a Smash Comics character by Robert Turner and Jim Mooney. And Madam Fatal is Crack Comics number one, art by Art Pinjian. So yeah, I have some more to read. And then this book is really fantastic because the first part gives you a sample of what these comics were, like actual printouts of these characters and comics of the characters that came from those eras in really good quality. And then you get the history of quality comics, like what they were about, the company in general, how they ran during the war, about their various characters. And then you get a whole section on the creators from quality, and then you get quality legacy at DC Comics. So this is more like how I know the characters is through DC Comics, because I wasn't around in the 40s. And
Oh,
then,
you weren't?
yeah, I wish it was. I would be crazy scared of the war, but I think it was one of the most fascinating times in terms of engineering development and stuff. It's just fascinating to me. And then they have like a character breakout of all the characters that appeared and the history of them, kind of. And you can like look up all of their appearances in Golden Age. So, like, if you look up the clock, it tells you who the clock is in quality. And if there were like pre-quality appearances, it'll tell you and their powers and such. Just, it's like reading like a who's who, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Except it has all their appearances. Bill Bulmer bought it because he saw this and he's like, that is awesome. So
That's cool.
it's a good book. They have some for the All-Star Comics too, but
Yeah.
I've always been hesitant to get them because they're always sold out of volume one and they haven't reprinted it. So it's like, where do you
Yeah.
start? Do you start with two? Which you could, but I always like to start at the beginning, at least on history books or books like this.
No, I know what you mean, because I've looked at those too. It's unfortunately, it's the same thing with the Teen Titans Companion too. There's two volumes of it, and
Can't get the first one, yeah.
yeah, I with which that I just got volume two anyways, because
Yeah.
that's cool.
Tomorrow's is awesome.
Yeah.
Like the thing that I like is you could learn a lot about comics history. It's not like Wizard or other stuff. It's all historical based. You're
Right.
like learning facts. It's like reading like factual data about the time and the creators and everything. And if it came down to budget and I could only get like a handful of comics, I think I would keep back issue because of just of the sheer amount of entertainment it provides per page.
Oh, I can see that. Makes
Yeah.
sense. That's
It'll keep
cool.
you busy. I don't get to read
Yeah,
all the
definitely.
articles I want, but they're always fantastic.
Nice. All right. So another thing I read via.
Sorry.
That's okay. Just don't let it happen again.
I'll go mute.
Just kidding. Via a IDW reprint, this time of comics that were originally came out under Eclipse Comics, is Airboy number one.
Ah, that one I did read.
Yeah, this is Airboy Archives Volume One, and it came out about a year ago, and it has issues 1 through 16 of Airboy.
But it's the Eclipse version. It's not the Golden Age Airboy, correct?
Correct. Yeah,
Yeah.
this is so Airboy number one originally came out in July of 1986, and it is written by Chuck Dixon with once again art by Tim Truman. And
Did you read it because of the image release of Airboy and you were curious, or?
I'm aware. No, not really. I mean, I'm aware. I think that's it reminded me of it recently. Maybe it's put it back in my mind, but
Yeah.
I'm just very interested in this era of indie comics with like Eclipse Comics and
And
First
first,
Comics.
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of good creators working on independent properties. And this actually is, I do like legacy characters, and this is, like you said, there was a Golden Age Airboy. It starts out with the son of the Golden Age Airboy. He's training with a man named Hirota out in the lawn. They're fighting with sticks, just training. Hirota's training him in combat. His name is Davey, and we get a little insight of what's going on with his father as they're discussing it with each other. Hirota tells him that his father would be proud of him, and he says, "Well, what difference would that make? He never comes out of his office. What does he care about my lessons?" But Hirota won't stand for any disrespectful talk. And but just at that moment, this helicopter starts flying in, and also a van on like propped up on huge monster truck tires comes rolling into the area that they're training, and there's men with machine guns to start firing on the property. And so Davy's father comes out and with his own weapon starts firing back, and Hirota pushes Davy to safety, to throws his staff that he was fighting with and takes the staff from Davy, and he's makes good use of them, tells him to get to higher ground, and starts fighting with the men, even though they have weapons. Like, Hirota's really trained in combat. Starts taking out a lot of the guys as Davy runs up into the house, but comes to a dead end when he's cornered by a couple men with the machine guns. And just at that moment, his father grabs him from behind and pulls him behind him. And he's shocked to see that his father has a couple Uzis, and jumps out and like takes out the guys. And Davy's shocked because he doesn't know this side of his father. So that Davy follows his father outside to try to help Hirota. He starts firing on the helicopter, and he's able to take out the helicopter. The helicopter explodes in the sky, and Davy's real excited. He said, "You got him, Dad. I didn't even know you had a gun." And then he looks at his father again and realizes his father's like full of bullets, that he took down the helicopter, but he got killed in the process. So as his father's dying in his arm, he says, "I'm so sorry, so much I couldn't tell you. Sorry, Valkyrie." And then he dies, and Hirota comes up at that moment, and it's like a few somber panels of them, close-ups on their faces. And so it's divided up into parts, and this part two is called Phoenix. And
So that Valkyrie is the one with the woman with the green shirt.
I guess so. I mean, he just says Valkyrie as he's dying.
Oh, but does he ever, do you ever see her?
Not so far, no.
Oh, 'cause she's, if you, I don't know if, look up Dave Stevens Valkyrie. Oh, she's sexy. Coming out of Airboy.
Yeah.
My great goodness gracious.
Yeah.
So you after you see it, you'll see why he said Valkyrie in his dying breath.
Okay. He's passing that on to his son.
Find the Valkyrie.
Yeah. So in part two, they're in catacombs beneath the monastery, and his Davy is still confused. He's saying to Hirota, this is creepy. Like, what shouldn't my dad be buried with my mom? Shouldn't we contact the authorities? Why all the secrecy? I know my dad was weird, but and Hirota tells him, "This is the way your father planned for it. There's a lot that you don't know about him, and your father has a lot of enemies, and it's going to take a while for us to find out who is responsible." And so they go into this room, and Davy holds up the light, and he's shocked to see just it's a huge treasure room. There's piles of gold and chests and paintings and suits of armor and stuff. And he said, "This is the source of your father's wealth. It's a legacy left to him by the monks who raised him. And now, it's his legacy. Now it's Davy's." And he says, "But this is not even the important part." He takes him into another room, and it's like basically an arsenal. There's just weapons of all sorts, and he holds up this red shirt with the yellow V and some goggles, and he said, "This is what your father wore into combat. He was called Airboy, the greatest fighter pilot in the world, and this was his base, and where he fought enemies in Germany and Japan." And Hirota reveals that because, obviously he's Japanese, and he says, "We were once rivals, your father and I was a pilot." Basically implies he was a pilot for the Japan, and he surrendered to his father. But Hirota doesn't think that the men who killed the original air boy actually knew his secret, that they but that whoever hired them probably did. And it ends with the vow for Hirota and Davy to find who ordered the death. And he it's like a splash page at the end with Hirota holding two martial arts swords with Davy, and in the background there's like a sketch of the original air boy and his plane. So yeah, I mean, it was neat. I liked it. I now is the new Image series, is it serious, or is it more of like a comedic take or something on it, or did I just see that wrong?
I have not read it yet. I heard
Yeah, I
somebody
mean, I don't
talk
think it's
about
come
it,
out
and
yet,
it's
but
somebody said it sounded like it's out. I have it.
oh, is it out? Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's a, based on the very few words I heard, it sounds very strange. Like
Yeah.
it's very it's going to be very different, but it is James Robinson and it should be pretty cool. I like James Robinson,
Yeah, me too.
so well, James Robinson has a lot. The thing I like about James Robinson is his love for the historical golden age. He loves that stuff, and he actually researched the stuff. So I like that about him. So I'm sure, no matter what the Airboy comic is, I'm sure there'll be a lot of history in there just because of I know the writer he is, you know. He doesn't usually go into something blind. He usually does a lot of research. And I think Airboy's first appearance was like in the Golden Age, an Airfighter comics. And then that eventually became Airboy comics. So the first appearance of Airboy was in Airfighter Comics number 2 in 1942. And my database says it's worth $2,200 in near mint, which is conservative. So if you look in Overstreet, it might be like 3,000. But that's for any of you guys that want to seek it out. But one thing that's interesting is if you do look at Airboy in the Golden Age, his costume is almost identical to his son's, which I did not know.
Yeah, it definitely
It's
looks.
definitely not a camouflage type costume. It's
No.
almost like a Western Buck Rogers looking costume. But he's just a fighter pilot, you know. But if you get to see him with the Valkyrie, oh my God, she wears this shirt. It's this green shirt. And it's just like open. She doesn't button any of the buttons. Oh God.
Yeah, I think in the beginning of the archive, the table of contents is basically cover images of all the issues in the book over a
Yeah.
couple pages, and I think I did notice it must have been her on the cover of one of the later issues, because
Yeah.
I noticed a woman in like a green shirt that was open all the way or something. For some reason, I don't know why that popped out at me, but.
Well, once you get to Airboy number 5, that's a Dave Stevens cover. That has Valkyrie on the cover with her standing over Airboy. The Dave Stevens covers tend to be worth a little bit more. So, like, if the find them in a dollar bin, this one might be like $7. They're not that expensive, but they are higher just because Dave Stevens' name is on it. But I have almost the full run of Airboy. I'm like missing 3 issues. of the issues that you're reading,
Yeah.
the eclipse that ran from 1986 to 1989. And I have read a lot. I was on that eclipse kick way back when I first started listening to podcasts, because Derek Coward, he kind of like talked a lot about Eclipse and First and Cameco. And because he did that so often, I ended up buying full runs of the stuff. Yeah, I have quite a bit of this stuff. I don't think I have a full run of Grimjack, but I do have some of them. But I got Airboy. Yeah, I really dig Airboy. And there was something I read recently from Moonstone. It was like Air Fighters, something or another. It was a new story by Chuck Dixon, and it was really cool. I dug it.
No, that's cool.
Yeah. Now he's at Image, so maybe we'll see him a little more often. But I should read that this weekend just to see what he's doing on it. It has a weird cover because it looks like it's got these two drunk dudes drinking on a couch, and they have a portrait of Airboy in the background. So I like have no idea where this is going. It should be an interesting one. So my last book is a book that I got from Keith Knutson, and it was a series I'm missing from DC Comics. He gave me a full run, I believe, of The Man Called Axe, AX.
Oh, okay.
Or you could
Interesting.
call him A10, like if you use the Roman numerals, because I think there's like an AII, X and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But this DC version wasn't very accessible, and I think it was after reading the little description in the back, I think it like continued off of the book from Malibu. So as The Man Called Axe, it was from the Bravura imprint, which was the creator imprint at Malibu. And I bought that recently, and I think Knutson heard me say something in a podcast, saying like I have a full run of this, because I recently completed a lot of the Malibu books, and he says, "Well, I have the DC version. Do you have it?" And I was like, "No, I don't." He says, "Well, I'll give it to you." So he gave it to me at Heroes Con, and I read the first issue last night. It's by Marv Wolfman and Sean McManus. Sean McManus, I've always dug his art, especially like when he was doing Dr. Fate in the 90s. It was awesome art. That's when Dr. Fate was changing between a male and a female.
All right.
Yeah, it was a really cool time. I've always dug his art. It's very distinctive. Like if you see Sean McManus art, his face expressions and his line art, they're very noticeable. But this was from 1997, and it was published by DC Comics. And Wolfman talks about how he went over in 1997, I think DC or in the later 90s, started allowing on their proper imprint creator-owned imprints. In other comics like Bloodhound and other stuff that you start seeing reprints of on Dark Horse recently, they started off as DC properties, but they had like creator licenses associated with them. Like the Mighty's currently appearing in Dark Horse Comics Presents, and that was a DC comic. So this is another one that went to it. They basically came over because Wolfman had a good relationship with DC Comics, and they were aware of his work at Malibu. But it read like it was a continue, like this was not a first issue, like it wasn't very accessible. And the thing that makes this book unique from anything else on the stands, I think, at this time, is it was 1997, and this book took place 3 years into the future. Only three, but it's 3 years is pretty significant. And it was in DC proper. So It took place in this city called Bedlam, and it seems like this town is like run by criminal overlords, and the man called Axe is actually somebody that came from the Desert Storm, and he works with a female companion that is actually kind of his like eyes and ears on the air, but she's actually captured in this story, and Axe is actually beaten pretty bad, and he actually loses an arm, but he looks like he has healing abilities because as soon as he lost his arm, he's like almost like a Bloodshot. You know how the nanites fix him? He almost is like that kind of character where he could be fixed. And he grows his arm back and ends up fighting these guys, but he's on the run, and they've captured his companion, and he's starting to remember flashback. Man, this now that I read this, it reads so much like a Bloodshot comic. It's very unusual, but it's very weird in the fact that it's a comic book series written 3 years in the future. So it has like future aspects, but not that much. Do you know what I mean? Like you see stuff that's 1997, but you see elements of technology that might be there in 3 years. So it's very unique in that. So it's almost like a Bloodshot character. So it was an okay story, but it wasn't very accessible. It didn't set you up other than it told you that him and the woman he flies with that are going after this criminal organization in Bedlam, they were from Desert Storm, and something happened to him that they took his body. Like their aircraft crashed. They were shot down by Scud missiles, which were missiles that were used to protect, to knock out other missiles. Their plane was actually shot down by them, and something happened between then and now that actually gave him. That actually made him who he is now, which is almost like this killing machine that can heal. Man, this sounds like Bloodshot. That's weird. I didn't realize it until this, I guess now that I'm talking about it.
Yeah, but as you're saying it out loud, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's cool. I hope as I read on that it'll start to clarify, or I'll go back and open up my Malibu box and just start reading those and then just continue with this. But one thing I do know is that they have done other A at the Roman numeral, like A1, A2, A, three, the characters, and this just happens to be X version of that, whatever that is. They make this like these technology soldiers, and he just happens to be that incarnation.
Interesting. Yeah, I've heard of
Actually,
that comic, but I don't know anything about it.
my database talks about it a little bit, but it does take place in that city of Bedlam, which here the police, the mayor, and virtually the entire populace are held tightly by the grip of corruption and unseen forces. The man called AX appears and made things even worse. So that'll be interesting. That's what the Malibu thing says. And then in the DC thing, my database says, after an unexpected time in comics limbo due to the desolation of Malibu's creator-owned imprint, and ultimately the entire Malibu line, the man called AX returns to the comic stands, this time from DC Comics. And it says you're supposed to pronounce it A like Axe, which is interesting. And it says during Desert Storm, Axe was forcibly recruited along with many other soldiers for a Millennium Project by a crime czar, Garrison Gage. Okay, they introduced Garrison Gage in this comic. I mean, he was already established, but we got to at least know who he was. Gage was a member of the criminal organization controlling Bedlam City and was attempting to create an army of programmable assassins for an even larger criminal alliance, the Cadre. How do you pronounce that? Is that how you pronounce it? Cadre?
I think so.
Uh,
Cadre, yeah.
X overcame his programming and dealt with a severe blow to the cadre's secret plan. Now, the aid of another Desert Storm veteran, Liz. Okay, so that's the character, the companion I was talking about. AX disrupts Bedlam City's corrupt routine while searching for clues to his past. That's the synopsis of the series, which is cool. I like the fact they don't do this anymore. But my database used to be loaded with this thing. There used to be a publication called Slings and Arrows. If you can find a copy, I'd highly recommend it. It used to be a print book, but it was a history of all comics ever published. And the awesome thing about Slings and Arrows is that you can like look up anything and it gives you a synopsis of the series, which the, it was no longer it's no longer published because of the there you go. Thank you.
There's your Merriam-Webster pronunciation.
So I did say it right.
Cadre.
Yeah. I kind of said cod, like with an O. Cadre. So yeah, it was it's more interesting now that I talk about it than when I read it. But yeah, I look forward to seeing where it goes because the art is really neat and it's kind of weird because Marv Wolfman talks about, yeah, I'm in a unique situation here because DC's letting me play with the DC universe 3 years into the future. Like I could have DC characters in my book. That's what's weird. In my creator-owned book. But I don't know if he can really do anything with them other than have them in there in some kind of non-impacting way. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it might impact the way that the city of Bedlam is his what happens to that city because that exists in the DC universe, but it wouldn't have an impact to like Batman or whatever, whoever character appears. But yeah, it's cool stuff. It's
Nice.
all classic.
Every single one of them.
Yeah, classic Airboy, classic police comics.
Well, my last one is kind of indie, although it was originally released by Marvel Comics. It was reissued by Dynamite, and it is The Shadow, 1941, Hitler's Astrologist.
Ah, I have the original.
Or
It's
astrologer, I mean.
I think that was a hardcover, a really large, big hardcover book.
Yeah, this is a really cool story. It's written by Denny O'Neil and Michael Kaluta with pencils by Michael Kaluta. And Michael Kaluta, like, they were on DC's Shadow series when DC had the rights to Shadow.
Yeah, the 20-cent shadow, yeah.
Yeah, and then
He's
Marvel
a great
puts it out.
artist, by the way.
Yeah, the art on this is fantastic. It's just beautiful. This graphic novel, it's like 60 something pages. It takes place in 1941, obviously. And so it takes place during World War II. And essentially, so one of the things that happened in World War II was that Hitler decided to go on the offensive against the Soviet Union, and that on that front, the Nazi army, the Nazi forces were really drawn out through the Russian winters, and they had a really long supply chain, and it just was like really a bad idea and kind of a failure. And a lot of people since have said that that might have been responsible for Germany losing the war, that they decided to go on the offensive against the Russians, because at the start of the war, they weren't aggressive towards each other, but Hitler had something going against the Russians going back to when he wrote Mein Kampf.
Also interesting is when they went on the offensive. This is fascinating to me, by the way, because this is something I'm really interested in. The Their tanks, it's really fascinating stuff. The Russians knew how to design their tanks for Russian climate,
Oh, right.
whereas the German tanks, they were not designed for that. So,
Yes.
plus their fighters knew how to fight in their climate. So things might have been slightly different if the technology was built for the environment that they were going to. So
Right.
Russia, I mean, if you look at German tanks, they were pretty badass, man. They designed them really heavy in the front, and they would take out Sherman tanks like nobody's business. But they had weaknesses in the back and stuff like that. But man, there's a book I want to buy that's like at Barnes and Noble. It's like the history of tanks, because I find tanks like fascinating. When I saw Fury, I was like, this is awesome. I love that movie. But it talked about that, which I think what you're getting to in a kind of like a very indirect way. But by saying how the Germans failed, well, one of the reasons they failed was because of climate. Yeah.
Yeah, 'cause I think I remember reading not so much in this comic, but like I find it interesting too, and I think I remember reading that a lot of the tanks would get stuck, and I think that the Russian forces were they had smaller numbers, but like you said, they had the advantage of knowing the climate, and they used it to their advantage, and the Russians burned a lot of like Russian towns down and stuff so that the Germans couldn't use them to replenish their
But
supplies and
the
stuff like
Russians
that.
too were crazy too, because the Russians would at certain times they'd will say like we'll try to overwhelm them with numbers, and they didn't even have the arms to support those soldiers, so they threw them out there with wooden fucking guns. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm
So,
getting World War I confused with World War II, but it's all fascinating.
yeah. So what this story essentially kind of takes place in that time period, and people have theorized why Hitler just made the decision, and so this story kind of like takes place in as a theory, relating to that, and involves a shadow, as if like the shadow is involved in a plot to cause that decision to influence Hitler in such a way that he will decide to attack Russia. And a lot of the shadow supporting cast are involved here. You have Harry Vincent, who is, you know, he like the way they describe it is they call him the shadow's hands, and then they have Margot Lane, the shadow's eyes, and Shrevey, he's an ex-boxer and a cabbie. They refer to him as the shadow's legs, and then Burbank, he's the shadow's ears. He's a communications expert. And then you have the Lamont Cranston, who's the alter ego, the shadow's face. And it also introduces a lot of the like higher ups in the Nazi party. You know, you have Hitler and Heinrich Himmler, Joseph Goebbels, Rudolf Hess. So what this involves is like the title implies Hitler's astrologer. There were certain members of the Nazi party. Hitler may have been influenced by astrology. I think Rudolf Hess is known to have put a lot of faith in astrology, and then there were others in the party that thought it was total bullshit. But that's what this plays off of. And the shadow, he tracks down this woman named Gretchen Baur, Baur.
What was the title of this again?
The Shadow, 1941, Hitler's Astrologer.
Okay. Thanks.
Yep. So they get. So Margot Lane and Harry Vincent, they find this woman, Gretchen Baur, and she's being tracked by other, like there's two opposing forces in the Nazi party that want this woman, and she's being tracked by some of them. And so Harry Vincent takes her and puts her into the back of a cab with Margot Lane. And they reveal to her that they know that she's been in America since 1938 on the command of Joseph Goebbels, and that she's been collecting astrological information for the German Ministry of Propaganda. And because that's what Goebbels was in charge of. So she's been pretending to be a graduate student at Columbia University, but she's actually a member of the Nazi Party. And she was running from Germans that said that they were U.S. immigration officers, but they were actually from a different group called the Auslands Organization, not the Ministry of Propaganda, and that they were trying to abduct her. It's really cool the way that they handle the shadow in this. Like, the cab stops, Shervy's driving it, and the cab stops, and the shadow gets in, and all of his word bubbles, have that like jagged line around it to give you the impression of his voice being like real creepy quality that his voice has. And he talks to her from the front seat a bit, to tell her that the Auslan organization, which is head up by her, a guy that's sort of her uncle, sort of a family friend, he's the one that's behind these men trying to kidnap her and bring her back to Germany without the knowledge of Goebbels and the Ministry of Propaganda. And he shows her badges that he found on the men that were following her, which we saw him take out, and that they're badges that would belong only to Nazi Party members that were in before 1933, which is like when the party really made their first strong move to take control of Germany. And a lot of people joined up with the party after that because knew at that point that they were going to be like the ones in control, so they scrambled to join. So we have several sequences throughout the story where they talk like at the German party, and they're discussing astrology, and there's the father of Gretchen. He's like the main astrologer that supposedly has information, and Goebbels wants to reveals that he knows that they're trying to bring his daughter Gretchen back, that the Auslands organization. It turns out that Goebbels does know this, and he's letting it happen. Back in New York, Gretchen is with Margot Lane, and they are taking Gretchen back to her place to try to get her clothes and her passport and stuff like that. And as they're collecting the information, some people show up and start the building on fire. So the Shervy, the cab driver, he has to run in and help protect them, and he gets Margot Lane out of there. But while they're in there, Gretchen gets pulled out of the cab and taken away. So they have to track her down, or try to track her down. So the story jumps ahead, and there's kind of a cool sequence where the shadow shows up at this meeting in New York of American Nazi Party. They're having this event, and he shows up, and there's always that like laughter drawn in the background, and he shuts off all the lights, and there's this woman, Annie O'Shaughnessy. She's an Irish woman that's a part of the party, and she's like, "Bread that that laugh now, fancy pants, 30 bullets, says your dad." And meanwhile, the shadow's mocking her from the darkness, and she's just firing like crazy. And then the lights finally come back, and the shadow grabs her by the jacket, and you see just like the bodies of all the other men that were in the place, dead from her shooting. And he uses his girasol ring to hypnotize her and cause her to speak and give her give him the information about the where they've taken Gretchen, that she's been taken to Coney Island, and that there's a U-boat that's supposed to pick her up. So the shadow and his companions launch a sequence, launch a plan to stop the U-boat and protect Gretchen, keep them from keep her from being taken by them. That's a pretty cool like action sequence, and involving like a plane that comes in, and the shadow's like firing down on this boat from the plane, and they throw all these hooks onto the boat and pull the boat up out of the water. And meanwhile, like a sub catches on to one of the things, and they have to cut the cables to keep the plane from getting taken down. So long story short, they end up take Gretchen ends up going back to Germany, and she's the reason that her loyalties eventually switch is because Shadow and his helpers track down her mother, who she believes to have been killed. But it turns out that this uncle of hers, this guy that she thinks is a family friend and stuff, has actually mutilated and tortured her mother. And so she meets with her mother in this small wooden shack on the docks, and sees that her mother's alive. She's like lost her eye, and she's all scarred up and stuff. And that this man she thinks is her uncle is not actually her uncle. It was her mother's lover before she met Gretchen's father, and that he is insane. So that is what convinces Gretchen to work with the shadow. I won't go into as much detail to the second half of the story, because I think it's like really just the subtleties of all of the plots and the mechanizations that happen on both sides of the war are really interesting. And just it's worth reading just to look at the art. But they as I mentioned before I started talking about it, though, there's an attempt basically to get to for Gretchen to use her status as having abilities to read astrological charts to use it to influence the to influence Hitler and to make him think that it's the right thing to do to attack Russia. And how she gets into a position of of actually meeting with Hitler himself, and the way that the shadow there's a lot of, there's several more cool sequences with the shadow fighting the man that she thought was her uncle and like his depravity and stuff. And it's really, really excellently executed. Friedrich uses like a lot of different panel layouts throughout the book. They're all like square panels and stuff, but he varies the size of the squares and rectangles that he uses. Sometimes there's like a page here or there that's all small squares, and just like every page is different. And I think he has a lot of control over the flow of the action as a result. But Shadow's very cool throughout it, just really like badass, and they use that laughter a lot to make him seem really ominous and stuff. So very, very high quality graphic novel, definitely recommended.
Yeah, I want to go upstairs and see if I have that. I'm pretty sure I do. But I don't know if my wireless will make it that far on my Bluetooth. But yeah, it sounds like a great book.
Yeah, if even if you read it at one point, it'd probably be worth going back to.
Yeah. I don't remember any of it, to tell you the truth. But it sounds like something that would really I'd really dig right now.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I realized it's 60 something pages, and it was taking a while just to say like the first half of what happened and stuff, so I figure I'll leave it there for people to read. But
Well, how did you read this on Scribd or what?
yeah, it's on Scribd because Dynamite has stuff on there.
Yeah. Is that are the viewers on there pretty good or not really?
It's pretty good. They did an update when I first subscribed. It wasn't as good. They did an update that holds the page better. It would sometimes the controls to advance the page would were too touchy, and the page would advance when you didn't want it to, or wouldn't like line up properly with the screen.
Yeah.
And they did an update, and it's been working a lot better since then. But it's only like it's like the price of Netflix. It's like $8 or $9 a month, so
And you seem to be getting your money's worth.
it's pretty worth it. Yeah, because I've been in addition, it's one price for
And
everything.
then
So,
the audio, yeah, you said
right,
you're doing the audiobooks.
yeah. So,
We got one
if
other last minute question before we
okay.
jump into Buck Rogers. This is from Joe Crawford. Which dead universe or character would you like to see in use again, and by which company? DNA agents in the, like he gives us an example, like DNA agents in the Valiant universe or something like that. That's an interesting question. I'd like to see what I'd like to see is the two dead universes that I'd like to see. All the stuff like DNA agents and First and stuff. I liked them as the because they were standalone. Do you know what I mean? Like I don't want to see my John Sable in Bloodshot or something, you know? I like it being its own thing. But what I would like is if Marvel actually did something with the cross-gen universe again.
I was just thinking of that.
Marvel would do something with that or with the Malibu characters, the Ultraverse, like
Yeah.
bring back Prime. You don't have to bring back like Prototype because he's like Iron Man, but you could bring back like Hard Case, but he's like Wonder Man. I mean, Prime, I don't think they have like anything like that because he's like a Shazam. He's a young kid. They could do something with Prime. I'd like to see that, or Firearm, or any of those Ultraverse. The Strangers could fit in. Like in any kind of like Avengers or you know some kind of X-Men setting, except they were powered by like the subway incident. But yeah, I'd like to see those two universes revived, and Marvel owns them from what I understand, so they could do like they did do a Roos and a Sigil and a couple of others, but they didn't take off. That's the problem. What I want isn't what everybody else wants. That's what that's the issue is I know all these properties, but the mass consumer don't give two shits about them, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, when they did do those brief cross-gen series, Marvel, they weren't part of the Marvel Universe really. And they were also different takes on the characters. I mean, the Ruse one was pretty similar, I believe, but then like the Mystic and other ones that they did were like different. So people that had read the cross-gen one and liked it
Were turned off because it wasn't that.
Yeah, and then and everybody else
Bruce
just didn't
was,
know what
though,
the
I
hell it
think.
was. Roose was, yeah, but
Yeah, the
I
other
think that
two
was the only
weren't.
one. And I don't know, they probably would be better off like introducing the characters into the Marvel universe, and then if like they take off as people get familiar with them, launch like a solo title.
Well, the one
But
thing I liked about the cross-gen is that they were very loosely coupled to the whole universe. Do you know what I mean? Like if you read Roos, you didn't have to read anything else.
Right.
Like the Sigil is the only thing that linked everything together, but a lot of these things happened in different places, like space. Sigil was in space. Meridian was on its own fantasy land. Sovereign was in its own fantasy land. You know what I mean? They all kind of
Yeah.
fit like themes that you don't usually find in comics too much. You had your sci-fi, your fantasy, your horror, Route 66, you know? You had like all these different themes that were very loosely coupled, and they may never cross over. You know, they tried to, like with the Negation War and stuff towards the end,
Yeah.
but it was very loosely coupled. And like the first was about the gods, and they were related to a lot of what was happening in the universe, but they never, you could read that by itself and be fine.
Yeah.
The Way of the Rat was like a Bruce Lee book. You could read all these cool books, and they were tied to like this continuity, but they stood alone, which I kind of liked. Like, I don't want those characters to be with Thor and Captain America. I want them to be like my favorite book was Meridian. I love that book. That was my favorite. And the other one, I can't even think about which one it was. I have to look it up, but a lot of them began with S. And the other one was about like a sword and sorcery type thing,
Was it
but with the
Sojourn?
it wasn't Sojourn. Sojourn had Arwen with the arrow. That was Greg Lanart. It was the other
Was there
guy with the sword.
Sojourn, Sigil?
Ah, it's
What the
gonna
hell was
drive
it?
me crazy. I've named almost a lot of the titles and I can't think of it, but
Yeah, I have to
Meridian and
look up
that
a
other one
list.
was my favorite. Let me see if I could Google it real quick. Cross
That's what I'm
gen
doing too.
titles.
Scion.
That's it.
Yeah.
See how they all began with S? It kind
Yeah,
of
there was
like
a
was
lot,
like a
yeah.
confusing. Scion and Meridian were. Hey, what is this trial by fire? I don't know, have that.
There was a bunch of issues of Scion that had Jim Chung art. That was the first place I ever saw Jim Chung, and like after Cross Gen ended, he ended up doing work at Marvel, but
Well, some of these artists really blew up at Marvel.
yeah, he
They
was one of
just,
them.
yeah. El Cazador was like pirates, you know? That was awesome. The Path was great. These titles were just fantastic. But the Malibu characters could fit in the Marvel universe. Do you know what I mean? The
Yeah.
Ultraverse, because they're the superhero, and there are certain characters in that would fit in. Yeah, you could say, oh, Sludge is kind of like Man Thing. You know what I mean? That they all have their, but there are like a lot of subtle differences. And if you own them, why the fuck not? You know, I don't know. Throw them in there.
I think it would be easier for the in the real world, I think it'd be easier for them to do cross-gen, because I think they
Yeah,
own those outright.
CrossGen owns it outright, where I think there's some weird thing with Ultraverse where they have to do something with the creators. They have to pay something.
Yeah,
There's
because
some
Malibu.
weird clause there
Yeah,
in
because the
that
way
department.
Malibu did it, they allowed rights to the creators of the
Yeah.
characters or something.
And Marvel would have to be profitable to do it. And CrossGen, they've tried, and I think it's just like you're throwing something at the dartboard and see if it sticks, but it's not sticking.
Yeah.
And then the one thing that they had going for them is they could have launched it like it was never let they never left it. They didn't have to change it. Don't change it if it's not broken. Then they would have at least won over the fans of CrossGen.
Yeah.
And they would have had a consistent sales profile for that title.
Right.
But that was an interesting question. There's a lot to think about.
Yeah, I don't really have a different answer. I haven't thought of a different one while we've been talking. So I guess we talked about the cross-gen example enough
Yeah, we
that
beat that
works,
one
but
to death.
yeah.
But there's a few cross-gen titles that I haven't heard of, like this. I have all these, to my knowledge, but I haven't heard of like Trial by Fire. But they said that was Code 6, which was their version of Demon Wars. Yeah, I don't have that either. I think that's their licensing stuff. R.A. Salvatore, yeah.
That's the writer of Jizz,
The Jizz, yeah. That's
of Peace Guy.
why I do not have those.
Yeah,
Those were Code 6 comics, which was licensed properties and cross.
if it was R.A. Salvatore, it was probably fantasy, and that's probably why you skipped it.
But I liked fantasy. That this was the first fantasy title that I liked was Meridian, Mystic, and the other one I liked,
Scion.
Scion. They all seem to be in that like
That's true, they did kind of have that
fantasy realm.
feel.
Yeah. And I absolutely Meridian was like the shit. Like I read that as soon as it came out. It was my favorite. But then I loved all these other ones too. Like I remember it's amazing with the amount of comics that I read that I remember these things, but I distinctively remember the cross-gen titles because I enjoyed them so much.
Yeah, I read a lot of cross-gen. I think it appealed to me that
Or there really weren't superheroes
Yeah. What
in
happened there? Did you
Well,
go to a speaker?
yeah, sorry. Is that okay?
Did you have to go pee-pee or something?
No, my foot pulled the cord out of the computer.
Oh.
That was weird. All of a sudden, I heard your voice from everywhere. So yeah, cross-gen was cool. I said I every once in a while I get the thought, maybe I should go back and read some of those. And
Yeah, they did some interesting things too, like experiments, like with digital and trades. They would put like the Edge together, and it would have like they would group their titles into like if you like this, then you'd like these other three titles, and they
Yeah.
put out a trade like that, and you'd read issues of that. It was
Right.
kind of interesting. Yeah, it's weird how a lot of these companies have like great ideas, and they just something happens and they don't take off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a limited market.
Yeah.
But I don't know, we want to finish up with Mr. Rogers.
Yes. The one thing that I liked about this Mr. Rogers episode was it felt campy.
It
Like
did, yeah.
it felt like a season one episode.
There's definitely way more humor than we've seen in a while, I'd
Yeah.
say. Yeah.
It was like a crossover between the Time Bandits versus Buck Rogers.
Yeah. And it was written by Donald Duck, at least according to the title. It looks like squack. Don't know how you would say the name.
Yeah.
And I don't. Did you catch why it's called that? I don't
No,
think
no idea
I still
whatsoever.
don't know why it's called that. I thought it was going to be some big mystery that it would reveal. But I
This
don't
was
know why it's called
a fun break after the last one because it was very lighthearted. It
Yeah.
was this Zardonian ship. They actually rescued these generals, and they were all generals. That's what's weird. And they're all small people.
Yeah.
They have one private that they command, and they give it to the black guy. I can't believe that.
Yeah, that was
That was
Tony.
weird.
That did you recognize that guy?
Yes, that guy is a guy I recognize right off the bat.
Yeah, Tony Cox, his name is
Yeah.
COX, and he's been in tons of stuff. He was in Friday and
Yeah.
Willow, and he's like been in. He played
That's
an
what I remember
Ewok.
from Willow. I remember
Yeah.
from Willow.
He's still acting today. He's been like
Yeah.
in some horror movies
And he
and
looks is very similar.
rap videos,
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. He he was a very entertaining character because you had all these generals, and they're always shouting at each other. That's that, that was kind of humorous because they're always they don't know how to talk at a normal speak. The only one that talked at sort of a normal speak was this private guy.
He was hilarious.
Everybody else was like just shouting, like rah! They're always shouting commands, and they're just totally mischievous. And they have powers later on that they use, but it was really cool. They rescue this ship, and then it's a bunch of shenanigans on the ship because they can't keep their. They get bored, and they go fuck with technology that they don't understand, and they fuck with the ship. They fuck with the robot, which actually fries him, which he actually has a brain. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, like a positronic brain, they call it or something.
Yeah, that was weird. You got Twiggy back, like doing his jokish things or his like buckisms, if you will. It felt great. And Wilma looked hot in this episode. She looked hot. And those guys were all over her. They wanted her so bad. They kept on talking about the bumps on her chest. You're a female? What do females do? They have bumps on their chest.
Yeah, they didn't know what to make of her. They were fascinated.
Think off, think off, think off.
Off think.
Off think, yeah, that's what it was. Off think, off think, off think. They were like, they had powers to do stuff, and by doing the off think, it started to take her clothes off. And then they cut away, and I'm like, fuck no, I don't want to see what's going on. I want to see what's going on in the other room where they're off thinking off Wilma's clothes.
She wasn't too happy about it though.
No, she wasn't.
Yeah, well, because she got stuck with them like earlier on. So they take them, they go to visit the bridge, and they all introduce themselves as the general, except for, and they're like, "Well, where's your crew?" And Tony Cox says, "I'm the crew." And then they had like been eating, and he takes this banana peel because he just finished the banana and just like throws it in the corner. But and
He
so then
was
they
definitely the best character. I mean, those other guys were just they were just shouting all the time and doing crazy shit. And he was like the one that you could talk to and reason with at least.
Yeah, and so they introduce they meet Wilma, and like you said, they're just fascinated and like, "Look, she's got bumps, pretty bumps."
Pretty bumps.
And she's just like overwhelmed, like freaked out by them, and she makes a point to stay away from them for a while. But like you said, Crichton gets hurt because they short circuit something or whatever. They mess up some technology, and that causes the ship to go off, like almost like throws off its alignment or something. Like,
Yeah.
and so he goes flying, and he gets dented in his head, and it messes up his brain. And they're just like, especially in this one part of the ship where the generals are just causing all this like havoc, and they're just cracking up at all this electricity flying all over the place, and they're just laughing their asses off. And Buck gets pretty pissed with them. He's like, "What the hell are you guys doing? Like, why are you laughing at this? This is not funny. Like, you're risking our lives." And they're like, and part of it's because they don't realize that humans aren't naturally grounded. Like, they're not afraid of electricity because they're naturally grounded. So if they get hit by electricity, it doesn't even affect them. And they're like, "Oh, humans aren't like that."
Yeah, he closed circuits that one wire. Like when they want to fix it, that one character is like holding them together and the electricity is going right through them.
Yeah, they have to they're like, "Well, if these guys are naturally grounded, and we can use them as a conduit," and like all the generals, obviously, they order the private to do it, and so he has to stand there and like hold the wire, like the ends of the wires in each of his hands, and act as a conduit until they can find a permanent fix for it to get the ship running again. But Buck's like exhausted, so at one point Wilma accidentally runs into them and like tries to turn and walk away, but he's like, "Oh, hey, Wilma, here, it's your turn. Like, why don't you take care of them for a while?" And So she tries to lock him away in a room, but unfortunately they have powers that they don't know about, and like you said, they can come almost do like a mind meld kind of thing, and then they focus and they can do off think or they can do on think, and they can cause things to happen that they want.
Yeah, if they can focus on an object, it seems like they could do something.
Yeah.
And they end up doing some good later on because they actually bring Crichton back. But Twiggy sacrifices himself before that to bring Crichton back as a Twig. They calls like Twiggy 8 or something like that. I can't remember what the number was, but he comes. Twiggy actually saves Crichton so Crichton can revector them because they were going into the sun.
Yeah.
They're basically going into a huge sun, and they were gonna all die. And Crichton was the only one that could fix it. And because of Twiggy's sacrifice, they actually were able to vector themselves away and steer themselves away, which kind of saved the day. And then all those generals were able to save Crichton, his real brain, by doing their magic on think,
Yeah.
kind of thing, by using the doctor, Goodfellow, as I guess his thoughts to fix the brain, whatever
Yeah,
they
so they
were.
knew what to do. Yeah, because it's like, really, they saved Twiggy too, because Twiggy's brain, he's a lower model, so he doesn't have like the capacity to control Crichton's body for a long period of time, and it wears his brain out. So when they put it back in, Crichton, like, his brain is able to operate Crichton, but not it doesn't have Crichton's personality. It's just functional to do what they need to save the ship, and so yeah, so it's the little people that are able to give Twiggy and Crichton their personalities back.
Horny little fuckers, man. There
Yeah.
was one general, I don't know if you noticed in one scene, that was chasing a woman. Did you see that? And
Yeah, later on, yeah.
Buck had to go grab him because he like cornered her into a room and she was screaming bloody murder, and Buck was, "Get the fuck
Yeah.
out of here."
Yeah, because they do explain to Wilma at one point. So, like, they use their powers to get out of the room. That's how they escape the room that she locked them in. And then, before they try to use their powers to take her clothes off to examine her, they explain to her that they haven't seen a woman because, like, it seems like they're almost like bees or something, where like there's just one
Queen,
queen,
yeah.
and then they're born in eggs. Actually, they hatch out of eggs, so that's why like they've never seen a human female. Like,
Or know of like females in general, because the only
yeah, like
thing they
having a
could, it's like there's the queen and then all these soldiers.
right. So like, yeah, they're not familiar with the idea of having like two genders to a species. But yeah, like it was definitely entertaining, and it was fun to have an issue with some humor.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're like backpedaling, realizing that like their new approach isn't really working out, but
Or they know they're being canceled and they're like, fuck it, let's just have fun.
yeah, maybe.
This didn't work.
Right.
I would imagine by now they knew they were being canceled or they were at risk yet, because we only got, what, three left?
Yeah, seems like something like that around there.
Yeah.
So,
It was a good lighthearted episode.
yeah, I was entertained by it for sure. So,
I had good dreams. Off think.
You probably keep trying that, huh?
Yeah, I keep watching that episode and I rewind and I was thinking, maybe if I could just off think it to finish so I could be in that room when it was actually happening. Because you see her
Maybe
like
it'll happen
garments just
different
go
this time.
poof. I can't remember if there's like a movie called Zapped, or it's one of those movies where a teenager gets some kind of powers and he's able to do that kind of thing. I think that was zapped, but I don't remember.
That's how most teenage boys would use that power.
Yeah. Off think, off think. All right. Well, that concludes this episode
I'll do
of
it, I
the
guess.
Retrocast. And you can reach us at MythMakingETC on the Twitters and at Mike Myers Brunch. Hopefully you're gonna make it to Baltimore so
Yeah,
people
it's
can
still the
meet you.
plan.
Yeah.
Yes. That's still my plan.
Unfortunately, I
It
don't
should
think
work out.
Campbell's gonna be there this time, so you won't get to meet Chris. But I think Daryl will be there, and hopefully Knutson will be there. And maybe Alan will be there because Alan wasn't at Heroes. It was
Yeah,
weird
that'd be
because
nice.
we usually have Michael Batzel. He wasn't there, and Alan wasn't there, and Micah wasn't there because he's in Japan, and there wasn't everybody there that's usually there.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of fun. So that's our Twitters on Geek Brunch, Facebook. You could search for Geek Brunch Podcast and click the like button. You can also find Chris's other podcast there, because you post the links to that show on there as well.
Yeah.
And what else? Oh, we're on geekbrunchpodcast.com, where you can leave comments, but we never get them. And our emails are Mike at comicbooknoise.com and Chris. Oh no, what the hell? I was gonna say Chris at comicbooknoise, but it's mythmakingetc@gmail.com.
Yes, sir.
And you could send us emails there as well. And until next time, until we cover the next episode of Buck Rogers, until we talk about whatever comic books that we're gonna talk about.
Good one.
We'll be out of here. So it was great talking to you again, Chris. And
Yes.
you had a lot of good comics this time that brought back some memories and made me want to go see it. I'm gonna go upstairs as soon as this ends just to see if I have. 'Cause I remember this book. And I don't know if it's the
Yeah.
exact same thing. I remember the size of it because it's like really big. It's a really
Oh,
big
is it?
hardcover,
That's
yeah.
cool.
But I can't picture where I have it. And I'm going to go look in the one spot that I think it is to see if I have it. But we'll talk to you next
Sounds
time
good.
and take it easy and have a good rest of your Sunday.
All right, yeah, you too. Enjoy. All
All right, bye.
right, bye.
The shore, an orchestra's playing.